From the Internet Law and Policy Foundry, this is the Tech Policy Grind podcast. Here, our fellows chat with leaders in the internet law and policy space on recent developments and exciting topics such as AI, privacy, internet governance, cybersecurity, tech legislation, and so much more. I'm your host, Justice Shannon. I'm a member of the sixth cohort of the Foundry Fellowship. The Foundry is a collaborative organization in internet law and policy for internet law and policy professionals who are passionate about disruptive innovation. Today, I am speaking with researcher and Dr. Jennifer King. Doctor, would you like to introduce yourself?
Thank you so much for having me. I am Dr. Jen King. I am the Privacy and Data Policy Fellow at the Stanford Institute for Human-Centered Artificial Intelligence.
I'm very grateful to have you today. Thank you for taking your time to speak with myself and the fellowship. As I told you before we started, we're going to start with a few questions about you, and then we'll hop into some substantive questions about age assurance. That work for you?
That sounds great.
Phenomenal. What career opportunities interested you most K through 12 prior to you discovering internet policy?
The first career I remember ever wanting to have was to be an ice cream truck driver, quite honestly. I think because I like ice cream. But it's funny, I was one of those teenagers who was interested in politics the way that other people are interested in sports, and I still am. I had an early subscription to a political magazine, you know, when other people were probably reading, you know, 17 magazine back in the day. And when I entered my undergrad, I did my undergrad at the University of California, Irvine. I was a political science major and never changed. I just knew that from the very start. But I didn't know what I wanted to do with that. And so that was a process that you could even say is still evolving, quite honestly, at this point in my life. Although at this, I would say now I'm pretty much married to internet policy, so I don't see myself changing that. But it was also in part because there was no clear path to this career when I started. And I also, I transitioned into it really late. I was, I graduated and about 15 years went by between when I graduated from college and when I went to grad school. So it was a very long developing progression for me.
And if I may ask, what did you do for those 15 years?
So I, after college, I moved to Hawaii. I worked teaching kids how to take the SAT. I moved to San Francisco the Bay Area in 1998. And lo and behold, I walked into the internet boom. And I had been an early internet user. I had one of the first email accounts when I was an undergrad. I still remember the first time I ever saw Netscape Navigator and what we know of as the graphical internet in around 1996, visiting my best friend who was a grad student at Stanford at the time. But I didn't really, I think, grasp like how monumental that technology would be in my life. So when I arrived in the Bay Area, I first worked in journalism. I later moved to different internet startups, kind of originally trying to trace a path into journalism. But I made that switch away from journalism really early and ended up in what we used to call web producing, but later product management. And the last major company I worked for that anybody would know, well, maybe because things are changing, is Yahoo. So I worked in trust and safety product management at Yahoo up through 2002 to 2004. And after that is when I began kind of slowly transitioning away from working in the internet sector towards moving towards academia.
I'm going to trust that most people still know what Yahoo is.
You'd be surprised.
I'm going to take that for, I'm just going to take that on its face. So why academia? What was the pool for you?
So when I first went to graduate school, I went twice. The first time I went to the program that I did eventually get my PhD from, University of California, Berkeley School of Information. And when I first went, I got a master's degree, and I was intending on going into user experience research and design. I had been exposed to that field when I worked at Yahoo, and I thought that was just a really interesting career, and it combined a lot of different interests for me. However, when I graduated, I really, at that point, knew I wanted to do privacy, and that's in part because of the work I did with my mentor, who became my PhD advisor, Professor Deirdre Mulligan. She was the first one who showed me that privacy was something you could actually do as a job, which I just didn't realize at all. But at the same time, I was a little early on the scene. I wanted to do privacy-focused user experience work, and nobody was hiring for that at the time. I interviewed at several large companies. They just didn't know what to do with me. It was like, well, you can come and, you know, work on a bunch of different products, but you can't really specialize in this. And also, why would you, right? But I knew that's what I wanted to do. And I was very lucky. Not long after I graduated, Professor Mulligan was able to actually hire me as a researcher. So I went and worked for her at the Berkeley, UC Berkeley School of Law at the Samuelson Public Policy Technology Clinic. And I was their kind of first and maybe only researcher, staff researcher. And during that time, I started doing kind of initial research on RFID, video surveillance, public surveillance, these different digital privacy issues that are in many cases still with us today. So after doing that for a few years, I had the opportunity to apply to the PhD program at Berkeley, and I did, and I was accepted, and that's all that happened there. What brought me to where I am.
And to our viewers who are considering a PhD or considering academia as a career field, what's your hot take?
So, I mean, I think there's a lot more opportunities for tech policy than there used to be. I mean, there were no fellowships when I was thinking about wanting to work in this field. I did come to DC as a Capitol Hill intern once upon a time while I was an undergrad. And so I always do recommend that to anybody who's interested in working in public policy to take that opportunity, if you have it, to go to DC for a summer or more and see how things work. It really was tremendously valuable to me. And I think now there's more opportunities to also do that with tech policy. But I would tell people to try to do something experiential like that first. And there's also more master's programs, I think, available. The PhD to me is one where you are really committed to a particular area and to some amount of scholarship. And you have some idea what you want to do on the other end. You certainly don't need a PhD to work in tech policy by any means. And actually, I would say that academic jobs, like true academic professor level jobs, are scarce. They're hard to get. So if you go through this process expecting to get one, you may be disappointed. So it's one of those career paths that I think is clearer than it used to be. You don't have to get a law degree necessarily, although I know a lot of folks listening either probably have one or are considering it. There are other options, but yeah, I wouldn't say the PhD is the best way to get into tech policy, but certainly I wouldn't also tell somebody don't do it. Just be really thoughtful about what it is you want to do with it.
Thank you. If you're ready to jump in, we can jump into the age assurance, the Absolutely. World of age assurance. No. I guess a very basic starting point for our audience. Can you define age assurance, age verification, and age estimation?
Sure. So age assurance is what I would think of as the big bucket of issues around how do we know how old somebody is when they are using the internet, or specifically when they come to a particular website or app. And then within that, age verification is the high certainty focus. That is like, I need to know exactly how old you are, period. Versus age estimation, which is maybe just what it sounds like. I need to have a rough idea of how old you are. I need to estimate it. So with it, those two, verification and estimation, are probably the more like either end of the spectrum, and that whole spectrum itself is age assurance. The idea that we need to actually figure out how old somebody is before they use a particular product or service.
So age assurance is polygons and age verification and age estimation are rectangles and squares.
Sure. No. I think that works.
Can you briefly just give a couple examples of age verification technologies versus age estimation technologies?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, age verification would be actually checking somebody's ID or, you know, some type of proxy to find out exactly how old they are. So in the real world, this is you present your license before you buy alcohol at a grocery store. Or if you want to go into a venue that only allows people over 21, again, you have to show some form of ID. So when we talk about age verification online, I think this whole, let me just say that up front, this is a really tough and complex debate over kind of what to do and when to do it and how. But I do think it has suffered in the public sphere from a real lack of depth and specificity. So just, and let me be clear that I'm speaking just for myself and nobody else, not for Stanford or anybody else. But my sense is that when we're talking about verifying age, we're mostly talking about areas online that we would not want accessible to kids under 18 and maybe under, or young adults 20, under 21, that similar to that we wouldn't allow them access to in the real world. And so that's my take on this very kind of US, United States focused discussion. Obviously, we are witnessing globally this discussion play out right now in different ways. And I'm sure that we'll talk a little bit more about what they're doing in the United Kingdom. But that, I think, has been a much broader approach to trying to identify not just places that we wouldn't want kids to transact, but more broadly about content that we don't want them to see. And it's had a much broader impact on internet usage than maybe what we're talking about in a more narrow focused way here about specific areas where we'd want to verify age.
Thank you. I think you started to move into the next question rather smoothly. So what is the social value of age assurance technologies? And what are the, on the other side of that, what are we potentially giving up by adopting these technologies?
Yeah. Well, so let me just add first that I talked about verification. You know, when would we want to estimate age, just to get that out there? I think a lot of the issues that we're talking about around content, again, not adults only content, the way we might think of pornography, you know, certain films that are rated R, you know, that kind of world of, again, where if you were in the real world and you wanted to go to an adult bookstore or to a movie theater to see an R-rated movie, you know, arguably they are not supposed to let you in if you're under the age of 18 and potentially 21, depending on where you are. But the estimation space is one that is much broader for thinking about, well, where are the places, these kind of public and quasi-public places online where kids have access or where they congregate, where we may want to change their experiences such that, yes, there may be some content we don't want them to have access to, but also how do you shape their experiences in a way that's developmentally appropriate for them? And that thinking, I think, is behind a lot of the work we've seen on design codes around kids, especially, you know, starting with the UK, but the ones that were imported here to the US. That we're trying to think about, you know, how do you allow kids to be in these spaces, but give them experiences that are appropriate for their age? And I really need to credit Dr. Jenny Radesky, who is a developmental pediatrician at the University of Michigan, for really, I think, beating that drum about developmental appropriateness. Because we often simplify this discussion around, well, it's either appropriate for kids or it's not. But I can tell you, as the parent of two teenagers, that there's obviously a huge range of what we would consider appropriate for a four-year-old online versus a 14-year-old. And so We often just reduce these discussions to this kind of either it's on or off, that it's like restricted or not restricted for kids. But I would argue that within that bucket, there's actually a much more challenging, but again, nuanced discussion around how do we think about estimating the age of a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old or a 4-year-old versus how do we deal with 13-year-olds or 14-year-olds? And then in particular, I think that age 15 to 17 is one where we run into the most challenges trying to differentiate them from an 18-year-old, for example. You know, 18 is this kind of magic barrier that you pass. And we know that developmentally, it isn't, you know, necessarily a magic threshold, but that is kind of where we have placed the age of majority for children transforming to adults in this society. And so I'm not going to pick a fight over whether 18 is the right age. But just to say that a lot of the concerns around younger children, again, are not, I mean, yes, some of it's around, you know, can my kid get access to adults only content? But it has also been around what's developmentally and age appropriate for a 5-year-old on YouTube versus a 13-year-old.
I want to veer a little based on the answer that you've provided. Age estimation technologies frequently use more permanent data types, specifically biometric data types, versus age verification, which will use like a government ID, which is hard to replace but replaceable. Is there a concern in this space of the permanence of age estimation technology
harming? Yeah. Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh, no. Please take over.
So again, this is one of those discussions where you really have to focus on like which piece of the problem we're trying to solve.
Yeah.
So when we think about the permanence of the data that we might need to make these decisions, how long do we want it to stick around? I mean, I think one of the first challenges is that if we're talking about kids, obviously, kids are constantly changing. So, you know, from year to year, estimating or verifying, you know, somebody's age is going to be a challenge. And, you know, that's true for adults as well. Children just change more rapidly. I think part of the, you know, I am a privacy advocate researcher. You know, by advocate, I just mean I, you know, think privacy is a worthwhile value that we need to protect. And so I find this debate really interesting because I would certainly not advocate for any method that compromises people's data privacy. That said, this is a space where I feel like despite industry kind of yelling about innovation left and right and the need for the freedom to innovate, this is one of those spaces where I feel like industry has often just thrown up their hands and basically said like, well, we can't solve it. We cannot innovate around this. Just to say that in these public discussions around how we verify age, I think there's been a lot of attention paid to things like, oh, we need to use facial recognition technology, or we need to use these, you know, methods that seem very privacy invasive on their face, while at the same time not really having a broader discussion about, yeah, and maybe the most extreme form of this technology you might be considering, you know, government issued ID verification by the government, you know, face scans, fingerprinting, whatever it might be. Like, that's not necessarily what we need to do. I think there's a much broader kind of discussion we can have about what's appropriate for what space and what can we do that's privacy preserving. I think there are a lot of kind of privacy fears in this space, in part because we don't have baseline protections across the entire US around what companies can and can't do with their data. I would also just add that in the US, it is really unlikely that we are going to devise a verification system. And so here I'm talking about like actual knowledge of somebody's age that is run by the government, you know, either federally or state by state, both because I don't think there's an appetite for it. People will really be concerned about the government checking their ID before entering an adult website, but also because I don't honestly think that we need to go to that extreme. For example, I have TSA PreCheck clearance. I went to a third-party vendor in order to get that TSA PreCheck done. Just to say, I think there are a range of solutions we could consider that don't go to the kind of extreme of we need to take facial scans, we need to save those for any point in time. I think there's probably a lot more lightweight ways we can get into this problem, you know, outside again of those that very narrow space of instances where we absolutely want to make sure that the people in this space are not under the age of 18 or 21. So please feel free to ask me a follow-up if I know that was a really broad-ranging answer. I'm happy to dig into a piece of that more specifically.
Yeah, yeah. So I think you're around the space that I'm trying to get to. I think for this specific question is age estimation technologies specifically use, age estimation technologies can use permanent data, whereas age verification technologies frequently don't need permanent data. I think this creates an interesting harm or an interesting potential harm where if you visit certain age assurance platforms, they'll say, you know, most of our users want to use the age estimation solution rather than the age verification solution. Is there an issue to be grappled with here, or is it an environment where users would rather use age estimation despite the permanence of the data being used? Is that an acceptable risk?
Yeah, I mean, I think again, this issue also often gets blown out of proportion because people, I think, argue and honestly in bad faith that you're going to need to submit government ID to, like, you know, view a news site. And I don't think at all that's what we are trying to angle towards in the US. And you could, of course, be forgiven for looking at what's happened in the UK, where I think there's been really over broad restrictions based on how people have interpreted that law that have prevented adults from getting access to content that seems like they should be able to, that it's, you know, the question around whether kids should have access to it seems really kind of poorly interpreted. But of course, they do have a totally different, you know, basis for the law than we have. So again, I think that this is one where we could think creatively about if there is a subset of websites or apps or services that you absolutely, you know, should be sure that somebody is not under 18 or 21 to access. And therefore, you either have to, you know, present a credential that you're over that age or somehow prove that you are not under that age. We can, again, think about ways to do this that does not have, let's say, the state of Texas, you know, building their own age verification system and being the one that is the intermediary between the content you want to see as an adult or the service you want to access and the provider. At the same time, I think it's also rightly people have raised the issue that putting the burden on these different providers will basically put a lot of them out of business. And I think that is a really fair critique, that this shouldn't be something that just gets thrown in the laps of all websites to deal with on their own. So there's got to be another way, right? And that's the piece where I feel like there's been very little kind of collective discussion and potential, again, opportunity for innovation around thinking about what are ways that we can potentially solve this problem. And, you know, I would say this is certainly a space I would love to see the tech industry step up and try to, you know, do some interesting problem solving in a way that is fair, so that it's not a financial gatekeeping, essentially, you know, that if just because you can't pay, you can't get into something, and that potentially offers multiple ways for someone to authenticate beyond, in some cases, maybe it is limited to like a government issued ID, no Costco cards, probably. It's been one of the more interesting stories I've heard about real ID, people trying to fly with their Costco cards. But again, I would point to something like we have done with PreCheck, where it's not the TSA reviewing my eligibility for PreCheck. It is one of these private services that has enabled that process. And then, basically verifies that the documents I presented are the real deal. So, I think there are different ways to think about doing this. I do think that, again, trying to think about like how do we creatively and innovatively solve a problem like this, we tend to think about these online problems as only having online solutions. And I think that reliance on automation and kind of only thinking about doing things online is part of what has gotten us into this mess. And so, you know, the same way that I may have to go to the DMV to get my government issued ID, maybe you have to go to an in-person provider to get a credential that allows you to have access to a, you know, subset of sites that require knowing that you're over the age of 21. Unfortunately, maybe that's the friction that gets introduced to this process.
I did not imagine in my wildest dreams that you would present offline age verification as a substance, as a substantive topic. Thank you. I'm very grateful.
Just trying to keep me thinking.
it's my favorite thing in the world. So offline age verification isn't frequently discussed. I haven't seen a platform provider that embraces this as a concept. Can you describe how that would work for? Yeah.
Sure. I mean, I think, again, you could imagine a range of things. So maybe it is something like PreCheck, right? Where you have to go to a third-party provider and just get some kind of credential. Is it a two-factor authentication key? Is it a like particular token? Like, what is it? I'm not sure. Like, that's not my expertise. And that's where I would say, hey, you know, tech, innovate on this one. Like, give us some interesting solutions. But maybe it is a two-factor key, much like we use to get into other sites. And that allows the provider to verify that, you know, this third party has said that you're over the age of 21. You enter in a, let's say it's even a rotating, you know, kind of cryptographic key, right? It's not a like single identifier like your cell phone number, which is now becoming next to your social security number as the most reused credential anywhere. I think there are ways to consider doing this that doesn't put the government in this role, because again, I just don't think we're going to see that happen, and that will be extremely unpalatable, I think, on kind of all sides of the political spectrum. And I just don't think that this is something that you can only delegate to the online sphere. Or again, there's a range of options. If somebody wants to use facial recognition to verify plus their state ID online, okay, maybe you can. Maybe that's a, you know, authorized way of doing so. But I don't, again, I feel like these debates get limited by arguing like there's only one way to do it. And I'm going to go out on a limb and say, I don't think so. I think there's multiple ways we could think about doing it. And I would be in favor of doing something that is as privacy preserving as we possibly can find, rather than as invasive as we can find.
Thank you. It sounds like not only are you advocating for you're advocating for a privacy first option, you're also advocating for, it seems like, an options first option, if that makes sense. Like, if a user is okay with reducing privacy to also reduce friction, you're okay with that user having that choice.
Sure. I mean, I'm a privacy researcher. I can't tell you, you know, I run into any number of people who will say, hey, I've got nothing to hide. I don't think there's a problem. I'm not worried about it. And who am I to tell them? I mean, I can certainly say, hey, I think there are risks here that you aren't considering. But it's not my role to bully them into saying, no, you have to care. So, like, I accept that as a privacy researcher, there are always some fraction of the public that does not care, that they are fine with these solutions. I think the goal, again, is like, what can we do that's fair? What can we do that doesn't end up discriminating on the basis of income, on the basis of any protected characteristic? that makes it like much easier for one set of users versus another. And so I mean, that friction piece would be important, but I think if you really want to be able to have some like pseudo anonymity in this space and still be able to age verify, then we should figure out a way to do it. Again, I don't think it's impossible. I think it's just a question of like, what are the trade-offs that we can do? And certainly some people might say like, hey, I'd rather just have you take a picture of me and show you my ID and get it done with, and you know, on I go.
Thank you. And so I did want to discuss the difference between offline age verification and online age verification, but I was more thinking in the space of like going to buy alcohol or going to the movie theater, as you had mentioned. And I was hoping you could address or you could explain some of the differences between the two. And I mentioned this specifically because the recent case, FSC v. Paxton, didn't really get into that. And I was wondering if you were interested in broaching if there are a different set of concerns from verifying one's age on in person versus online.
Yeah, here, I'll give you one that I think this is a real life one and one that I have dealt with personally as a parent. And that is sports betting. Okay, so sports betting apps are proliferating. They are targeting mostly young men. Depending on what state you're in, they're either completely illegal, such as where I am in California. Doesn't matter what age you are, you can't use them. There are other states where you have to be 21. I don't remember if there's anywhere where you can be 18. But I know of kids under the age of 14 who have been able to place bets on sports betting apps, which you should not be able to do, at least in the state of California, full stop. And you probably should not be able to do anywhere in the US. And how were they able to do that? Well, because there was no kind of age, you know, no real age gating mechanism when they downloaded it. They were able to download it from an app store. The app store doesn't check age. The platform, their device may know that it's a child device, but it wasn't enforcing necessarily the age limitations. And then the last piece is that the sports betting app itself is not engaging in any age checks, probably other than a like, tell us you're 21 or over, you know, agree. And then they're relying on credit card use. And that is the number one thing that companies have often used as a proxy for at least somebody being over the age of 13 is access to a credit card, because when you're under 13, you cannot use a debit card. And let me tell you, my 12-year-old tells me this all the time. When do I get to use my debit card, Mom? And yet, again, I know kids who've successfully placed bets on sports betting apps here in California. So you could potentially attempt to try to keep kids off your platform. You know, first is the device level. You know, if it's a kid device, the parent is the one who administers it and tells the device how old the kid is, then the device should have some knowledge of what a child can and can't have access to under a certain age. And this is, again, developmentally, I think it's 13 and under where this is probably the most reasonable and important, and it's tougher over 13. The next is the app stores, that, you know, a device that Apple or Google knows belongs to a kid may have access to an app that is not meant, not only should not be legal in the state that you're residing in, but is, you know, not kind of age checking there. So that's like another failure point. And then again, the reliance on credit cards. Well, you know, unfortunately, we're in a world, or fortunately, depending on your perspective, where kids can use debit cards and credit cards. So just relying on the use of a credit card, I would argue, in many cases is not sufficient. And then finally, there, you know, then we could bring up this kind of question we've been debating so far, which is like, what type of age estimation or verification should a sports betting app do, right? So if you had all those other checks in place prior to placing a bet and you still a kid got through them, then I think we'd have to ask ourselves, and what should the sports betting app do before somebody actually places a bet? You know, do we need to actually verify that the person's over 21 and in a state where it's legal, or what? So let me pause there because I want to make sure I'm still answering the question. that you started with.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I want to circle back a little. You mentioned the goals. What are the goals of the age effect of age assurance technology? Like, what is the purpose of using the age assurance technology with respect to sports betting? Is it making sure that the user is over 21, or right. is it like make sure that the user is over 21 and in a state where sports betting is legal? You can imagine a world where a user has a California driver's license, is over 21, but is physically located in a state where sports betting is legal.
Sure.
So validating their using their California driver's license to deny them sports betting would actually defeat the purpose.
Yeah, that is a great example.
The question that I have here is how effective does your age assurance need to be to meet that goal? Is there a number? Is it like 95% of users are properly age gated, 99%, or does it need to be 100% effective? And is that true in offline experiences of age assurance as is?
So, I mean, this is where I would love to punt some of those details, but I mean, I guess I would say that it's obviously hard to be 100% effective. We could obviously go through, you know, real world use cases where people get access to things all the time that they're not supposed to because the gatekeeper looks the other way. You know, I, like so many other, well, I mean, I know I can remember when I was a teenager, everybody knew which convenience store sold alcohol to teenagers. You know, and that was your best bet if you wanted to try to get beer because they were willing to take that risk. So, and I'm not, we live in the real world. I can see why you want to shoot for 100. Like, what should the liability be if you're wrong? I think it depends, obviously, on whether you're like the liquor store that just continually looks the other way, or, you know, there's always going to be edge cases where something happens. So, I think we should be reasonable in our approach and not, kind of overly punitive. But that said, I mean, I think there are some legitimate concerns. Again, and I think the sports betting example for me is a really good one because I don't see any legitimate case of, well, again, it's totally against the law in California, but of any kid under the age of 18 or potentially 21, I assume it should be harmonized with our state gambling laws, being able to place a bet on an app. So I guess I'll just weigh in on the side of saying I think we should put reasonable limitations and not expect that it will be 100%, but you know, you got to put in the effort, I would say. I don't know if that was a satisfying answer to your question.
No, it makes sense. First, I want to ask, was that the ice cream truck in the background?
Oh, no, wind chimes.
Darn. I was going to say it's so timely if that was an ice cream truck in the background.
There is an ice cream truck that trolls my neighborhood, but that wasn't it.
Yeah. No, thank you for the answer. Much appreciated. I'm asking in the context of FSC v. Paxton again, because that case seems to imply a want for 100%, or at least HB 1181, I should say.
Yeah.
Implies a want for 100% effectiveness. But in the real world, we don't know if that's actively possible. But also, states... state alcohol laws also pursue 100% effectiveness, even if it's not truly feasible there as well.
Right. Right. And, you know, I'm not an enforcement expert, but obviously I would say we would need to shoot for, contextually what makes the most sense and what is possible with the available technological options. I mean, I do want to put a quick plug in for a paper by Professor Stephen Bellavin, who's at Columbia University. He's a computer scientist. He put together, I think, a great short paper that walks through the flaws. And I would I think it's fair to say his take is that a kind of true age verification without potentially revealing, you know, or causing some level of privacy issue is a near impossibility. And I think also does a good job of highlighting all the ways in which people try to circumvent these things. And so again, like I would just argue we need to be realistic about understanding kind of what the circumvention might look like. And yeah, what are the trade-offs? But I would say, I mean, I guess I would kind of, again, circle around two points. One is that I think it's fair to say that there are particular activities online that we don't allow in the real world that we should do our best to make unavailable to kids. And I think sports betting is a really good example of that, just because it is kind of this gateway to larger gambling. It can be, obviously not for everybody, but it can be. And, you know, is a use of funds that you could call it entertainment, but it's definitely, it's not an investment, we'll put it that way. But I don't know if the Texas law is focused really tightly on, let's say, adult content versus access to a broader, you know, range of content. I think that's where we start to get into that really uncomfortable and tough space around what's appropriate for kids, you know, outside of the set of categories that we've kind of agreed in the real world and not online are inappropriate. Because I share people's concerns with a lack of access to information, censorship, and so on. But I would point out in turn that a lot of the concerns right now with kids and social media, for example, have come because we are giving children access to products that were not designed for kids, full stop. And I'm old enough to remember a world when I worked at Yahoo, for example, where we had an entire portion of the Yahoo site designed for kids called Yahooligans, which I think was very popular and very well respected at the time. And I've been trying to think about, like, what happened to that world? Why do we not have so many spaces for kids the way I feel like we did in the early internet, at least briefly? And I suspect that it mostly comes down to the lack of ability to advertise and to generate revenue and the cost of running them. And I think it's a real shame that we've seen this abandonment of the space, where if we had focused instead on building more child-friendly spaces earlier on, we may have not run into the degree of kind of social harms that we've experienced. And so I feel like that's still an important part of the conversation when we talk about these issues, that we need to acknowledge that so much of the concern is stemming from a lot of real world harms with social media, and it doesn't have to be that way. And arguably that's what the age appropriate design codes were intended to try to address, you know, whether they did so well or, you know, have flaws, we can obviously debate, but, you know, the goal was again, to try to bring in some level of age appropriate or developmentally appropriate, design and content to kids, rather than letting them run loose on adult platforms where we ourselves often admit that we're being experimented on. We are beta testing in real time.
Thank you. What a phenomenal answer. I've been I'm using the URLs, which is why Googling is inapplicable, for my childhood website, game websites, so like cartoonnetwork.com. Right. It's not just a source for games that it once was in like the early 2000s when I was a kid. Coolmathgames.com is still coolmathgames.com. It's definitely been turned into 2020s internet, but it's still there.
Yeah.
And I have no, I'm trying to get to Newgrounds, but there it is, Newgrounds, everything for everyone, there it is. Although that is, I'm going to have to agree with you that is not the website for kids that it maybe once was. So I think that's an excellent point, that there's these spaces for kids that once existed online, maybe don't exist anymore. So I guess that presents another question of, okay, so we implement age assurance and the vast majority of the web of the internet adopts age assurance. And the vast majority of the internet is still not a space for kids online. Have we solved the problem that you are presenting as a concern?
Well, I think the short answer is that, again, this is a piece of that problem is solved at the device level. And that when I have a kid under 13, let's say, or even 13 or 10, that they don't need access to the whole internet. And that as a parent, I should be able to delegate some amount of their content access to the device, and in turn, kind of the app store in terms of what they're even allowed to access. So I mean, I think that is probably the most practical way to address some of these issues. I think the some of the different tech actors hate the, some of them like the ideas because they this idea because they don't want to do that level of kind of content curation themselves. So like Meta famously is in favor of this because it punts the problem to Apple and Google primarily as device makers. And, you know, I would argue it shouldn't only be up to the device makers. I can tell you that as a parent, my experience with parental controls is something that literally drives me insane. Week to week, the amount of time I spend having to deal with passcodes and enforcing limits. I mean, and I mean in a like responsible parent way. Like it would be nice if you could kind of set your device and not have to constantly monitor what your kids are doing. But even if, like me, you still have to monitor what they're doing, it is just unreal the amount of hoops I end up having to jump through literally week to week to try to keep these devices up and running in the face of parental controls. And here's just one quick example. My kid's on a Mac. He has a school that uses Google Classroom, so he's often using Chrome on the Mac. He asked me to limit his access to a particular website just because he didn't want to be tempted to use it. I went in last night to try to make this change within screen time on the Mac. Guess what? I can't restrict websites that he visits on Chrome on the Mac. Two things don't talk to each other. That is absurd. So I had to use a third-party piece of software on top of all the time I invest using screen time in order to try to make sure that works. It's just, it's maddening. And I have a PhD in tech, essentially. And it makes me insane. I feel such empathy for the parents who have no idea how to do this stuff, don't know how to navigate parental controls, don't have the time. Just to say, I think why you're seeing a lot of push in this area to make something happen is that I am channeling the frustrations of a lot of parents who are like, we care about what our kids have access to, and you guys make it impossible for us to really like responsibly hand over a piece of technology to let them do what they want. It is literally just a nightmare. So it is possible that if device makers and third parties both cooperated and put a lot more investment into parental control software and other types of interventions, that maybe we wouldn't need to solve these problems at the societal level. But I think what you're seeing is a lot of parents whose kids have been harmed or whose kids have had really bad experiences finally say like, look, nobody's listening to us. So yeah, maybe we'll see more cooperation to avoid these laws at the state level or the federal level in response to the issues that a lot of parents are raising.
Thank you. I have a few questions from the platform perspective, but I want to try to re-ask that question again from like a slightly different angle. I guess the question is there a possibility that like internet usage by youth can be addressed by creating more spaces for youth online.
I would hope so. I mean, I think that's a great question, right? I mean, I think it's kind of the natural follow on to me lamenting about the lack of spaces for kids online, right? I would hope so. I think the challenge is that the reality is that most kids are congregating on platforms, right? And the platforms have largely been reluctant to embrace kind of a kid-forward approach. Like, Meta has been on notice for, what, 5 or 6 years about teen use of Instagram? Probably more, because that research wasn't leaked until 2019, and it existed before then. And yet we haven't seen Meta move towards a kind of teen Instagram or a kid's Instagram, for example. Like, they offered up one product in the Facebook space, a Messenger product that I think was envisioned as a tool for kids to talk to their grandparents, essentially. Or maybe it was a, you know, way to take a bite out of Snap's audience, but I don't think it went anywhere. And, you know, Discord is another that is used by kids all over, but as far as I know, does not have kind of a kid forward, you know, version or platform. I think it is fair that it's a tough problem when you are talking about a broad range of ages. So I think Disney in the past used to have, I know, in fact, Disney used to have an online community for kids and a very, very locked down version of a chat tool. But of course, like, you can't make everybody happy. So like 6 to 9 year olds would probably be really happy on something like that. But once you're like 11 or 12, you're going to want something else. And is that reasonably now kind of pushing developers into making like 3 or 4 versions of the same site? I don't think it needs to be that extreme. But just to say that it's not like you can just have a kid's site and an adult site and then the problem solved. Again, because there's such a wide range of developmental difference between a 9-year-old and a 15-year-old. But you could have something that is kid like designed from the start and then have graduated features depending on the age set. You just have to decide to do it. And then we do have a kid's site, Roblox. But honestly, I think there are a lot of concerns with Roblox because it is entirely kid-generated content. And I think, unfortunately, like so many other sites in this space, they don't invest the level of resources and the actual trust and safety and moderation that they really should. Everybody wants to automate this stuff. They don't want to put humans in the driver's seat. And I realize, of course, content moderation, I've worked in that space. It is difficult. But that said, I think most of these companies lean really hard on automation to solve these problems. And they could do a lot more. But it is a tough space overall. I don't want to minimize the fact that it would be a big design challenge. But I also, again, it's like Silicon Valley is the center of innovation. But when we run against these hard issues, I feel like everybody just leaves the table and basically throws up their hands and says, we can't do it. It's too hard.
Phenomenal answer. Thank you. I like that we very well started in age assurance and we slowly moved away from it as we've addressed these fear of concerns here, as age assurance isn't the source of the concerns, it's a potential solution to the concerns. I want to come back to age assurance a little and look at it from the platform perspective for a couple of questions. From the cybersecurity perspective, if you are a age assurance provider, what is your commitment to disclosing vulnerabilities to the businesses you're partnering with or the consumers who are trusting you with their identity?
I mean, this is one of those spaces where I feel like a lack of cybersecurity policy in the US at the federal level contributes to, I mean, obviously there's lots of best practices. And if you're dealing with, let's say, you know, financial data, there are the different types of assurance standards that you can meet. But the baseline, like what are like the core, I'm thinking of FSMA for the US government, kind of version of what we would hold providers to in this space. I mean, again, I just feel like part of the problem, as with privacy, is a lack of kind of standards and regulation that sets a ground floor for what people need to do and be responsible for. So, I mean, I don't see how you get into this space without aiming for the top. I'm thinking right now of the AppT that, you know, was compromised recently. And that's one where they were holding onto people's biometric data. You know, they're holding onto copies of driver's licenses, and that you wouldn't assume that you were a target for, I mean, again, I don't know them. I don't know the company. I don't know what they were thinking, but clearly they did not have their security standards up to the point of deterring 4chan hackers, right? So just to say, I don't know how you get into this space without really trying to adhere to the kind of highest levels of trust and assurance that you could possibly have. But absent that, that could be one of the things that, if we do pass laws in this space, that those laws attempt to address, although I'd like to see that broadly for all sorts of different companies and not just companies collecting biometric data, for example.
Thank you for the answer. What should your obligations be?
Right.
I'll pivot to you. What have I left out here in this conversation that you feel compelled? What is your it in age assurance that you feel compelled to discuss? And we'll circle back to my last question shortly there.
Sure. I mean, I think I hinted at this earlier. I do think the debates that we're having on this topic tend to be framed in this very all or nothing approach, and have been dominated by a lot of folks, many of whom I know, who are holding on to a kind of version of the internet that I feel like really doesn't exist anymore. And again, it's very hard for me to separate my interest in this topic as a privacy researcher, but also as a parent, because I feel very close to the harms that teens in particular have been experiencing as a result of a lack of, guidance in this space. So, I mean, I think it just bears remembering that while, a lot of this gets tugged into questions of free speech, a lot of what we're talking about is not about speech. It's about behavior, and it's about access to marketplaces that kids shouldn't be able to access. And it's also, I think, again, about recognizing the big developmental differences between kids when we talk about kids, and how there's just a lot more complexity to this debate than simply simplifying it to, we're going to have a censored lockdown internet or we're not, or it's all going to be, government IDs or no access to anything. And I think that it's a real disservice to only frame it in those terms and to not kind of acknowledge that there are a lot of real problems that kids are experiencing that we should be more attentive to as adults. But thanks for allowing me to make that point.
No problem. Thank you. You're not out of the hot seat yet. I did remember the question.
Okay. And then I got to wrap it up because I have to leave and go teach a class, actually.
Perfect timing. So I've tried to couch this conversation in good old-fashioned Americana, although I have noticed a few times you brought up the UK and Australia. And while I don't want to, like, I don't want you to present and address their age assurance laws here and now in the few minutes we have left, I do want to acknowledge that there are now a good number of age assurance laws out there. You have Texas, you have Mississippi, you have Australia, you have the UK. France recently passed, is looking to pass an age assurance law. The EU is looking into age assurance policies. How do platforms grapple with the wide variety of age assurance requirements that they're facing at cost? You've already mentioned that there's a possibility of like niche websites just shutting down altogether because they can't afford to keep up. What is there a solution to this? And if there's not a platform solution to this, is there a societal issue, solution to this?
Sure. So I think a couple things. One is that the UK, other European nations, Australia, all have very different set of laws than we do. They do not have a First Amendment, or at least speech laws, in the same kind of way that we do, where speech can be very absolutist. And also, I would argue that they have governments where, I mean, we conceptualize ourselves as anti-federalist in a lot of ways. Like, we don't have national IDs. People still continually kind of cringe at the idea of having a national ID, even though we have passports, even though we have social security numbers, but, you know, we don't have a government-issued federal ID card, right? Just to say that I think in some of these other countries, this question of like who administers this process is just a very different landscape. You know, whether or not we agree it should be their government, I think there's potentially more palatability for that versus here, where, as I was saying earlier, I just think it's a no-go. And again, this kind of conception of speech is very different. And so I think it's hard to just compare. And I don't want to argue hard for American exceptionalism, but in some ways, you know, especially with speech, we are on the exceptional side of the equation. So I think it gets difficult to just generalize globally. But in terms of how companies respond, again, I think it will, I mean, I would assume that's part of the stakeholder kind of engagement process that they need to be advocating for if they don't want to be stuck doing that work, or if they don't want it all to be in a local government's hands to do that kind of age assurance or estimation. So, I mean, I don't think there's like a simple answer to this question other than obviously, much like the GDPR, the General Privacy, General Data Protection Regulation in Europe that drove kind of global compliance with privacy protection principles, we may see other countries lead in this area where we don't and set the kind of basis for how other countries will end up complying. I don't know who's going to take the lead in that right now. I would guess that because of the response to how the UK has rolled out their law, it's not going to be the UK. People seem really unhappy, at least what I've heard across the pond here, with how that's rolled out. But I'm skeptical we'll see somebody take the lead the way that the GDPR did with privacy. But we may see some of these issues decided more clearly around what are the ways in which we might practice age assurance or age verification. And again, we may learn from negative examples. We may decide, yeah, actually what we're seeing in the UK, we don't want the federal government or even state level governments involved with checking IDs. It really does speak to a private solution or a nonprofit consortium or, you know, what have you. I kind of imagine right now, based on the way the UK version has rolled out, that might be the big, learning we take from that experience.
Thank you. And it sounds like you're saying for smaller platforms, the answer might be sit and wait.
Yeah, I don't know what you can do. I mean, other than advocate or lobby. quite honestly, or engage with stakeholders. I mean, it is possible that the smaller platforms, news sites, what have you, should all come together as best they can and figure out their own proposal for how to cope with this. And that seems to me to be more sensible than just, you know, doing nothing. But certainly, I think that makes more sense than, waiting for the large platforms to drive this conversation, because I would assume that the large platforms don't necessarily have their interests in mind. So they're, you know, they're another stakeholder who should have a seat at the table.
Thank you. And we can leave it there. I promise no more questions. Dr. Jinking, I want to say thank you on behalf of the ILPF, the Foundry Fellowship. Thank you for your time. I know you're off to teach a class. Thank you for teaching us today.
Thank you. And I hope if somebody made it all the way to the end of this podcast, even if they are listening on like 2x speed, I hope it was useful and that you learned something from it. Thank you for listening.
You're appreciated. Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you, Justice.